right. So moving on to item five, which is the review of our total portfolio performance for the quarter ending June 30, 2022. I think we will be bringing in Mr. Whalen, Mr. Price. There they are. I see them appearing. This is actually Veris's presentation. So when we have, I'm looking around, my boxes have moved here. Thought we had him in, but
I am here.
Oh, you are there. There you are, staring right in front of me, and I didn't see you. So good morning, Scott.
Good morning. And
I think based on the order of presentation, we'll turn the floor over to you for the review of total performance, and then we'll hear from our staff following.
Thank you very much. As I generally do for these quarterly updates, I'm going to go over the economic landscape for a bit and respond to any questions you may have, and then turn to performance. And before I go to the deck, hopefully I'll have the opportunity to share. Yep, I see I have that capability. Before I go to the deck, I just want to give you a little bit of a historical narrative to kind of bring you all up to speed on what's been going on in the markets. And I want to go all the way back to the global financial crisis, where in 2008, 2009, you probably remember, the Fed came in and provided just an enormous amount of liquidity to the market, not only in the form of reducing the Fed funds rate, which is a big topic of conversation now as it starts to turn back up. Back then, it went from 5.25% all the way down to near zero. So monetary stimulus through Fed funds rate reduction, and also quantitative easing, right? The Fed went out and increased their balance sheet by purchasing securities, fixed income securities in the open market to the tune of about $4 trillion with a T dollars over those several years. Their balance sheet went from about $1 trillion, which was sort of steady state in 2008, to about $4 trillion in 2019, which equaled about 25% of gross domestic product. And then in 2020, that shot up again as they came in and made the decision that they needed to support the self-inflicted economic slowdown due to COVID. And that $4 trillion shot up to about $9 trillion, or about 42% of GDP. So lots of monetary stimulus. And then you add on top of that the $5 trillion in governmental fiscal stimulus, federal governmental fiscal stimulus. And you've just got this massive amount of liquidity that, you know, essentially saved the economy from going into a complete tailspin, but also has become inflationary. You combine that level of stimulus on the demand side with the supply side slowdowns because people weren't working and producing goods. So you had all this demand without any supply. And those supply side or those supply chain issues are beginning to work themselves out. But then you throw in the mix the Russian invasion of Ukraine, notwithstanding or over and above the devastating human tragedy there, you've got inflationary pressures in energy and food, and China continues to be impacted by COVID with their zero COVID policy and how they have these rolling sort of shutdowns when any spike in COVID rates comes up. So both demand and supply forces impacting inflationary pressures. Inflation, in context, back in 2021, in February, the annualized running rate of inflation was 1.7%. And then it started to ramp up. In March, it was 2.6. In April, 4.2. By the end of the year, it was running around 7%. And then, you know, that's when we sort of stopped using the word transitory and said, oh, okay, these inflationary pressures are really problematic and we better do something about it. Possibly peaking in June of this year at 9.1% annualized inflation, and then in July moving down to 8.5%. We'll get the August number sometime in the middle of September. And so then the Fed started getting serious and making comments that they needed to get this under control, and started raising that Fed funds rate that went all the way down to zero, 25 basis points up in March, 50 in May, another 75 in June and July, anticipating another 50 to 75 in September and maybe another in November. So they're quickly ratcheting up that Fed funds rate, trying to put the brakes on the economy. At the same time, they're slowly backing off all of that liquidity they put into the market through quantitative easing, saying that they're going to pull back about a trillion of that $9 trillion just by letting those bonds on their balance sheet mature and not purchasing more. So that's sort of the backdrop. And what that says is there's really this fight, this battle between inflation and growth. And what the Fed is trying to do, as you've probably heard in the financial press, is they're trying to thread the needle to a soft landing, right? They want economic activity to slow but not go into recession, such that those inflationary pressures on the demand side abate and inflation gets back down to the target range of 2%. You know, they've raised that target a little bit. They're saying 2 to 3% would make them comfortable. So what you're seeing in the market now is this battle between inflationary pressures and slowing growth. And it's interesting to watch because when the market is concerned about inflation and the Fed raising rates more, you see those rate-sensitive stocks, sort of growth stocks, rate-sensitive stocks getting hit more. When it's worried about growth and recessionary pressures, you see those growth-sensitive stocks getting hit more. So it's sort of a value growth battle between growth stocks getting hit when inflation is the concern, value stocks getting hit when recession is the concern. And it seems to trade off day by day what the market is thinking and feeling. We've got Chairman Powell is now at Jackson Hole, and I think he's going to speak on Friday. And so everybody is eagerly anticipating what he's going to say and what that means, what that implies for rate increases in the economy.
I'm just waiting for the iPhone 14. So that's where he was speaking.
You and me both. Okay, so with that, I will share my screen.
Scott, while you're preparing to share your screen, I have a couple of hands up. I don't know whose went up first because it was a photo finish. So I'm going to go Mike and then Jerry. You're on mute, Mike.
Yeah. Scott, I've been reading a lot lately about the China issue and how the drought over there could actually result in more devastation to their economy than even COVID did. What's your take on that?
So I've been hearing the same news stories that you've been hearing. We haven't yet from our capital markets research group really factored that into our thinking. Still bigger concern is COVID. But yeah, I've seen some of those pictures and the rivers drying up and it looks like it's devastating, but not sure exactly how that's going to factor through into China's ability to meet global demand for goods.
I guess the rivers drying up is causing a problem with them being able to provide energy, electricity to their plants. And so they're shutting their plants down, which is definitely going to affect their ability to provide, you know, whatever products they want.
Yeah. Understood.
Yeah. Take a look at Lake Mead on a recent photo and you'll see our hydroelectric future. Jerry.
If you take a look at Lake Mead, you'll also find that they're finding a lot of individuals there that folks thought they'd been put in deep enough water.
So, yes.
Hadn't been. So now I've begun to keep track of definitions coming out of the current administration in pencil because they're prone to a lot of changes. So would you like to take a position? I know we're all in agreement now. It seems to me that inflation is not a transitory event. They seem to have gotten off that. They have redefined
recession.
And so they now say, no, that's not true. We're not really in a recession. And the president proudly announced last month's inflation for July, or July was zero. So I'm having a little trouble finding tracking this stuff. So could we rely on Harris to give us an understanding on where we generally stand on some of these definitions?
Well, put your pencil down and get your pen out, Jerry, because I'm going to tell you what's going on. No, I'm kidding. So we actually put a piece together, and I'll be happy to send it to you, on the definition of recession. And essentially what it says is, you know, the two quarters, consecutive quarters of negative growth has been a longstanding sort of heuristic for recession. And typically in the past, and I don't know what the actual statistics were, but typically in the past, following two quarters of consecutive quarters of negative growth, the powers that be that officially call recessions have called a recession, right? But it doesn't happen until those powers that be, and I think there's eight standing economists on a committee that are charged with calling a recession or not. But typically in the past, those two consecutive quarters have led to an official recession being called. An official recession has not been called yet because we've had two consecutive quarters, but that standing committee of economists hasn't come out and said, yes, we are or were in a recession. So everybody's waiting on that. There are reasons to believe, based on other economic indicators like unemployment, for example, continues to be historically low, wage growth, for example, and inflation, that we're not in a recession now. But I'm not here to call it. I'm going to wait for the official group to call it. But that's why people are saying, oh, yeah, two consecutive quarters, we're in one. Oh, but there are other indicators, we're not in one. I'm just going to wait for the powers that be to tell me whether we are or aren't. And then with respect to inflation, so I said that June inflation was 9.1, July was 8.5. But that's the annual number that ends in June and the annual number that ends in July. In July, that month, the actual inflation rate for the month, month over month, was zero. So it just depends on which statistic you want to pull to state your case, right? What do they say? Lies, and statistics. And you can, you know, pretty much make whatever case you want just by using whatever statistic you want to use.
God, I think you have a future in the Biden administration.
Please bite your tongue. I am Switzerland on all things.
Oh, the last thing I noticed that was interesting was that even the numbers you publish put a lie to this, which is that the inflation rate in the United States is lower than everyone else's. And that's just not true. I mean, it's shown by the numbers there. There are lower inflation rates in Eurozone and various other places than there are in the United States. So it's difficult to follow this without a program to find out which dipstick they're using to measure.
And so you say that it's not true, and I'll bet there are statistics that support that. I'll bet I could find some statistics that support the other argument as well, which just goes back to whatever argument you want to make, there are statistics out there probably to support it.
Okay, I feel better now.
There's an old New Yorker cartoon that I wish I'd saved, but I've never forgotten the text of it, which is that if you torture the data long enough, it will confess.
Yeah.
And I've used that many times, and it's so true.
I like that. Yeah. Okay. So with that, I am going to share my screen. It says I don't have the ability to share. So maybe the administrator could help me out with that.
We'll get our best people on it.
There we go. Thank you so much. And go on to screen two.
There you go.
Okay. Okay. So, so those were the big points that I wanted to make. Now I'm going to use some statistics and data, at least I'm going to torture the data to make some of those points. So, here, the U.S. economic summary, and I'm going to stick mostly with the U.S. today. You can see some of these statistics as of June 30. So the 12 months prior, ending June 30, 2021, we're coming out of COVID, the big slowdown. We had the big rebound up 12.2% GDP. The period ending 2022, much lower at 1.6%, right? So we had the big pop and then things sort of slowed and normalized. Inflation, so this is core inflation as of 6/30. As I mentioned, CPI was 9.1%. So core inflation running hot, year prior 4.4%, still hot even in the prior year. That's when people were talking about transitory inflation. Expected inflation, interestingly, remains low. So the market is saying, and this is 5 years forward, 5 years from now. So thinking 5 years ahead and then the five-year inflation after that, inflation getting back under control. This was as of 6/30. The most recent print today actually is 2.4%. So a little bit higher, but still the market is thinking that inflation is going to, you know, it's not going to remain a long-term problem. The Fed funds rate is now at 2.25 to 2.50 is the current range. So that reflects the 75 basis point hike we saw last month. And then the 10-year treasury rate still relatively low. It's at about 3.1% now, you know, ratcheting up, but not shooting up. And the unemployment rate remains very low. I think now it's at 3.5%. So, you know, down near historic lows. So, you know, you've still got inflationary pressure, but the market thinking that that inflationary pressure will abate and the some of the other market indicators are sort of supporting that. Jerry, you stole my thunder a little bit on this page because I was going to point out and have the discussion that we just had about the two consecutive quarters of negative growth. So based on these numbers, one would say that we're in a recession currently, but there are other statistics that sort of belie these figures. And we'll wait and see what happens this next quarter and whether those that official group comes out and states whether we're in a recession or not. So shifting to inflation, here you can see the big spike up. It doesn't yet reach the levels that we saw back in the 70s and early 80s, but a significant jump. And here is some of the components of that jump. So here's that 9.1% for all, for CPI, for all items, and then food and energy being a big part of it. Now, you're probably aware that energy has come off its highs. I think it was up as high as 120 for a barrel of oil, and it's down now in the 90s. So that energy component of inflation has come down, and that was largely the reason for that decline to zero just in the month of July, right?
Hey, Scott, hold on 1 second. Jerry had a question. You had your hand up.
Thank you.
Just a quick one on the last, not so much a question, another observation on the last slide concerning unemployment. It's one of the other of my favorite statistics. In fairness to this administration, this differentiation has gone on in prior administrations, but the unemployment figures, you know, it always is amusing to me to see that they don't count people that have quit looking for a job as unemployed, even if they don't have a job.
Yeah.
So that's two very different ways of measuring things. One of people that are actively looking for a job, that's the 3.6 or whatever that percent was on that prior slide.
Yeah.
But there's nearly twice as many people that are, or half again as many people that are just quit looking. So they're unemployed, but they're no longer counted as unemployed.
I appreciate the fact that you keep giving me these great setups because we're going to get there as well.
I'm sorry.
Trusty Holcomb. No, it's good stuff.
Maybe they retired, Jerry.
we're gonna talk about that.
Nice try.
Oh, my gosh. I just am crossing a minefield here. I can sense it.
Perhaps they have quietly quit. Is that the new question I'm reading? I
can quietly quit.
I quietly quit. I love that one.
Can I quietly quit this presentation? Anyway, on slide 13, here is some indications of how inflation might be evolving. So the shelter costs, both housing and rents, you know, continue to rise and without any sign of abating. I guess I shouldn't say that. Housing seems to be slowing a little bit, but it isn't really reflected in the prices yet. This used car and trucks, these prices are coming down. You may recall that was a big sort of headline topic through COVID, as new cars weren't available. And so people were like paying new car plus prices for used cars and trucks. Those prices have modified and are even coming down a little bit. Commodities, as I mentioned, with respect to energy, which is a big part of the overall commodity index, has come off its highs. And shipping container costs are coming down as well. So alluding to maybe a little bit of that supply chain bottleneck alleviating. So some of the pressures on the supply side are coming down. Of course, the Fed with its rate increases are trying to impact the demand side. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we did see peak inflation last month, but there's still things working through the system, and it's not like it's going to get down to 2-3% in the near future, but possibly having peaked. Here's your labor market slide, Jerry, and you can see here this labor participation rate is sort of what you were talking about, right? So there's not, as this is indexed back to pre-COVID at 100, and there's not as many people in the labor force. Now, there's a big question as to why that is. There has been a number of retirements, and you can see that with the blue line coming down, that's folks 55 plus, with the blue line coming down more than the overall labor participation rate. But the labor participation rate in the orange line overall hasn't gotten back to its pre-COVID level either. And that follows sort of a long-term downtrend pre-COVID of the labor participation rate coming down. So nobody has a great explanation for this. Everybody talks about the retirement impact, as Dr. McDonald mentioned, but it doesn't seem to be the whole story, and nobody yet knows really what's going on. The interesting thing that I see is, you know, these people that retired, maybe they felt flush during COVID with the fiscal stimulus and high savings, but with inflation the way it is, man, I can't imagine that people are feeling particularly comfortable with their retirement decision today.
Hey, Scott.
Yes, please.
How are gig economy jobs factored into that? So if someone's driving for Uber or doing some other gig position, are they counted in the participation?
Yeah, I got that question before, and I think they are counted, but I haven't had a chance to confirm that yet. But I believe that the gig economy is factored into the participation rate. It's a great question, right? But I haven't heard that as an explanation, and I believe they are factored in.
Would that be under self-employment?
Probably.
Okay. Yeah, I was just trying to understand what data bucket they would in fact be in. All right.
So one point I wanted to make, I'm going to jump all the way to slide 23. You know, this is interesting here, right? So this shows on a rolling 10-year what the average Fed funds level was. And, you know, I'm going all the way back to 1986, the year that I graduated from college. Chairman Volcker, Fed Chair Volcker, was the commencement speaker. So, and at that time, you know, he had really put in place a program to tame inflation. But I'm 58 years old. The point is that most professional investors, period, have this experience, right? declining rates, salad days, rising bond rates, rising stock prices. And now, you know, we've reached a point where we're seeing rising rates. And the big question is, you know, how are markets going to respond when this long-term secular trend shifts to a rising rate? And I'm not implying that it's going to get back, the Fed funds rate's going to get back to 10%. But it could easily get back to 3-4% and maybe higher. And it'll be interesting to see what the markets do with the punch bowl being pulled away rather than refilled.
You know, Scott, that chart is telling, and I'm a wee bit older than you, and I think I've told this story before, but I can recall clearly in 1985, 86, applying for a loan. First of all, the CD rates were in the 13, 14% range for a certificate of deposit. And the quote I got on a unsecured loan at that time was 21.5% from Bank of California. And it's like that was the reality of 1986, that a lot of people either have forgotten or didn't experience, one or the other, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And as rates reset, valuations of everything needs to reset. Which takes me to my next slide.
Look at where you are today and where the Bank of California is.
Yes, you're right about that. You've been still here.
My next slide, I want to go all the way to slide 34 and talk a little bit about equities. And then one more slide and I'll wrap up and go to performance. But on this slide, I find this really interesting because in past reviews where I've come to you and talked about the market, I've talked about the expensiveness of equities and they're historically expensive. And you can see that on this center chart with these blue asterisks, I'll say, where back at the end of last year, relative to history, you're in U.S. equities, you were up near the most expensive ever. In international developed, as reflected by the EFI index, Europe, Asia, Far East, Europe, Australia, Far East, above 80, the 80th percentile, and emerging markets around the 80th percentile. So historically expensive has pretty quickly become either reasonably cheap or pretty cheap in the case of Europe. And of course, they've got problems of their own with concerns about where they're going to, how they're going to heat their homes and run their factories. But even in the US, you know, it's gone from near most expensive down to the 60th percentile. And you can see that here with these price earnings ratios sort of dropping off a cliff when rates started rising and the expectation of continuing rate rising. So of course, what that does, the mechanics of it, is you get your earnings, your cash flows out into the future. You have to discount those back at some rate to get a present value, which gives you your current price. And as those rates rise, those discounted cash flows become less valuable. So this is all about the increase in rates so far and not so much about discounting lower earnings into the future, which is potentially another leg to drop, which becomes really interesting thought exercise. So historically expensive has become reasonably cheap. And so that's just reflected in what you see in the lower prices today, which takes me to my next and final slide of this deck. Going all the way back to the last page here. And so this eye chart I like to show you guys every time. Apologize for the size, but you can get the point where you see all these red numbers going back to all the way back to a year. It was really, you know, in the last quarter or so that had the biggest impact. You can see the quarter for the S&P 500 down 16%. Interestingly, you look at the long term, the 10-year number. So the global financial crisis is now out of this. The COVID drop was just sort of a hiccup, a little speed bump before it quickly recovered. The 10-year number at 13% is a fair bit higher than the very long-term average of around 9 to 10% for the S&P 500. And so the 10-year market activity has been positive despite the last quarter drawdown. A couple of interesting points to note, things I've pointed out before and trends that continue. So you've got US as represented by that 13% over the long-term, relative to the rest of the world, minus the U.S. at 4.8%. So the U.S. is still remains sort of the strongest dog in the hunt. And then this growth value that I sort of alluded to earlier, over the long term, value is supposed to theoretically have an additional risk premium associated with it, which means value stocks ought to outperform over the long term. Over the last 10 years, growth, here reflected by the Russell 1000 growth and value stocks, growth has outperformed pretty handily over the last 10 years. That has reverted. You look at the one-year number, growth is down 18.8%. Value is down quite a bit less. And that's because of that environment that I mentioned, where you expect growth stocks to give you your earnings further out into the future, where value stocks, you're kind of getting your, clipping your dividends period in, period out. And so those earnings further out in the future are worth less with higher rates. So as rates rise, those growth stocks would be expected to do worse. And as inflation fears remain at the fore, you can expect growth stocks to expect to be worse. As inflation fears abate and recessionary fears move to the fore, you would expect that that to shift.
Hey, Scott, while you're on that point, Jay Kwan has his hand up. Jay?
Thanks. And first of all, Scott, thank you for the kind of a market recap. I appreciate the level of detail. Given the change in valuations you referenced across equities and I guess across rates as well, I was wondering, one, if you all came out with adjusted capital market expectations for the different asset classes?
Yeah, we are sort of unique in that we update our capital market assumptions monthly based on current market conditions. So we do our one big full-blown capital market assumptions assessment at the beginning of each year, and then we update them monthly.
That's great. What about for our plan specifically, our strategic asset allocation? I was wondering what the expected 10-year, 20-year return and risk looks like, or how that's changed.
So we haven't modeled your plan specifically with our monthly capital market assumptions. We don't do that automatically. It just means if we're doing a asset allocation review mid-year, we have updated capital market assumptions. I can work with Tim and be happy to work with staff on that if that's something that's of interest to you.
But I don't mean to make work. I guess directionally, would you expect kind of risk and return to have changed in what direction?
Yeah, not risk so much, but because we actually don't update risk and correlations, we just update the returns component of the CMAs. But I would expect returns to have increased. And I've done a couple of mid-year reviews, and the capital market assumptions for the total, the expected return, 10-year return for the total fund of the couple that I've done have increased by nearly a full percentage point. That was as of June. Of course, July, we've seen a pretty good bounce back and into August. So that would probably abate and revert back to closer to the original CMAs.
Great, thank you.
Okay, so that really concludes my comments on the economic environment, and I'll pause there for additional questions before I move to performance.
Don't see any other hands up. Let me take a quick look again. No, I don't see anything. So why don't you go ahead and transition?
Okay, thanks very much. So moving to performance, I'm going to take you to the next section in the deck. And here on slide 51, you can really see the damage that was done through the drawdown in the second quarter. You started the quarter with just over $11 billion. You had $800+ million in negative investment performance, getting you back down to about $10.1 billion. You can see it down here graphically. So the second quarter drawdown, these things happen, and they happen certainly more often than we would like. Not a time to panic, and you guys keep a level head you're very patient with your performance, and you understand that there are ups and downs, that you're a long-term investor. The drawdown, though, was a good opportunity to see how the portfolio performs under stress. And our expectation is that it will perform well under stress because you guys have set the portfolio up for downside protection. And it did And that's the good news. It was also a bit disappointing in that it didn't perform as well as we would have liked to have seen in this environment. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit as I go to this slide here, slide 56. So this is a very key chart and one we've been watching. I'm just going to explain what we're looking at here for a second and then talk about some of the key messages. So we've got 3-year look and a 5-year look. And what this shows is your performance, the total fund here, relative to the policy index as it's been set up. So that's sort of your bogey, your passive comparison to see how you could do and should do if you just invested completely passively. And then all these little blue dots are peers. So in this universe of peers, which is a public funds universe with plans greater than $1 billion, you can see where the median return is and the median risk in that universe, right? And so your policy index, you can see over the last 3 years, and it's a similar story over five, but your policy index set up, you know, the functionally focused portfolio, the investment program that you guys set up has just done really well. It's brought the risk down and it's got done better than the median peer, right? Which is exactly what you want. Quite a bit lower risk and a little bit higher return. The total fund has not kept up. So, you know, we have recognized that for a while and, you know, we don't make rash decisions and knee-jerk reactions. And we've been kind of waiting for a market like this to see how it did in a drawdown and how the downside protection played out. And as I said, it played out well, but not quite as well as we would have liked. Similar story for over 5 years, right? The policy index, median return, quite a bit less risk. Total fund doing a little bit worse. Now, there's a benchmark specific reason for this. So there's kind of an excuse, if you will, and I'll go into that in a second, but the excuse isn't completely satisfying. So we're going to talk about those things next. Before we do, the one thing that I want to point out though is your Sharpe ratio. We've looked at this metric before. That's a metric of your portfolio efficiency. 0.55 for the 3 years, 0.62 for the 5 years. That metric is still really favorable relative to other plans like you guys. That means that for the amount of risk you're taking, you're getting more return for each unit of risk. And that still remains really favorable on a relative basis. So let's get to performance. Okay, so the good news, as I said, over and above the fact that you have a really efficient portfolio, is that you protect in the downside. So looking at your performance relative to peers, you're in the 35th percentile in a pretty significant drawdown. That's disappointing to me. I would have expected to see you do better in this drawdown. So that's where sort of Tim and I spent some time as soon as this report came out, looking, digging under the hood. Both of us were a little disappointed, trying to figure out what was going on. And so the first thing that came up is there's this benchmark issue, and I'm going to explain it. You guys can ask whatever questions you want, but it has to do with how your private markets are benchmarked. You may recall, think private equity, the biggest component here. You may recall a year and a half ago, I came to you guys and said, I think you ought to change the way you look at your private markets on a quarter by quarter basis, because it's causing unnecessary tracking error to the benchmark. You're not supposed to be looking at that every quarter anyway. Let's just set that part of the benchmark as the return itself, and that'll solve the problem. Well, it solved the problem for the last 18 months, but we didn't go back and restate history using that same methodology. At the time, Tim and I talked about it. I said, you know, let's not bother with history. It is what it is. Let's just do this going forward. Well, if you were to restate it going, and that was kind of an unfair thing to do in terms of comparing to the benchmark, it made you guys look worse. If you were to restate it going back all the way back 10 years, that policy index, that 8.2, would actually be 7.7. The 5 years would be 6.3, and the 3 years would be 6.1, right? So it doesn't obviously change the total fund numbers. Your performance doesn't change. It changes the comparison a little bit. And that's, I think that's cold comfort, but an explanation worth stating. So, we're not going to go back and change it, but you should know that the benchmark comparisons don't look as bad as they do here, if you think about it that way. That's not to say that the private equity program was kicking butt all those years ago, because it wasn't. It's actually done much better recently as it's been restructured. But that's, as you look at these numbers, these benchmark relative numbers, you can take some comfort in that. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that in a drawdown, your portfolio didn't protect as well as we would have liked to have seen or expected to see, right? We were going along over time saying, okay, not really keeping up in this strong run up bull market. That is meeting expectations, but this is where it really should have shown. And it, as I said, it did okay, but you can see you underperformed the benchmark here for the quarter, the 1 year down considerably, still good relative to peers, but not as good as you would have liked, and not making up sort of the fact that you didn't get it all on the upside. So what's the issue, or what's the concern, and what are we going to do about it? The concern is that some of your active managers aren't performing as expected. You may recall that Jackson Square Partners was removed from the portfolio not long ago for that reason. And this drawdown has sort of shined a bright light on some of the other managers where they are not getting the return on the upside, which is okay, but you expect them to protect on the downside better in this environment, which they didn't do. So certainly not going to make a knee-jerk response to that, but what I would like to do and what I've talked to Tim about is we're going to dive in to the active manager portfolio and really do a thorough assessment and try and figure out why they're not meeting expectations. Really focused on domestic equity or the growth portfolio and domestic equity in particular, and then conducting a thorough assessment and trying to figure that out, planning to come back to the board with that study, that review, and any appropriate recommendations that come out of it.
So we have a question just on that point, Scott. There's a hand up from Jerry, and then I had a comment as well.
Sure.
And you may be planning on touching on this a little bit later because I think it comes up in more detail, but again, I hate to continue to show my tenure here, but Emerald Advisors has been a fascinating firm to watch. The volatility of that organization, or its return, its performance, if you will, has been fascinating. Every time it seems to me that we start getting nervous about them, they outperform in the following quarter, dramatically.
Yeah.
And then underperform, and then they outperform. It's just, we've come close in a couple of cases to saying we've had enough of Emerald, and then they perform spectacularly in the following year.
Well,
we think that might be the same pattern now.
Yeah, so that is a really good point. And if you look back at Emerald since inception, they've done quite well, right? 12% versus 9.9. So that's good, strong outperformance. And to your point, Jerry, I'm glad you brought that up. So a couple of studies have shown that institutional investors make the wrong choice at the wrong time, or maybe the wrong choice at the right time. But what they do is they fire right before managers come back, and they hire right before managers go down. There was a seminal study done by Walhall and Goyle, I think it's over a decade ago now, where they looked at 3,000 portfolios and showed that the by and large, those managers that fired outperform and the managers that are hired underperform. We actually did a very similar study mirroring their methodology with the Sackers plans and found the exact same thing. So I really appreciate that. And that's why patience is our watchword. We have been patient and we've talked about performance benchmark relative performance pretty much every quarter. and identified that you haven't kept up in up markets, where it didn't meet expectations in down markets, which raises the yellow flag, which is why we want to do a deep dive now. And not implying that anybody's going to get terminated, to your point, but we want more information.
Well, you addressed one of the points I was going to make with respect to the seminal study and the you know, firing managers, you know, at the wrong time and hiring them at the wrong time. But all that said, and really, this is probably more of a Tim Price question, but, you know, I guess part of the look-see here or the analysis has to, at least we have to put on the table how long our patience period should be, can be relative to peers. In other words, what's the general view on this in terms of how other funds have reacted to similar performance statistics? That doesn't mean anything other than just trying to find a comparative data point somewhere just to have something to you know, be a guide. And I realize that we've extended a lot of patience to a number of managers, and I don't know if that's a factor. In other words, does that exacerbate those numbers when you look at a long term view of where we should be relative to peers?
Tim, I'm happy to let you jump in there. I have a response, but I'll pause to see if there's anything that you want to say on that.
No, I mean, Scott, you kind of were referencing, you know, was it more my question? But I think, you know, Scott Whalen, you've probably got the, go ahead and take it first, because I think, you know, we have to take a look at this kind of through the lens of what Sisera is trying to accomplish, and recognize that we're a little bit different from our peers. But that said, we're always trying to learn from our peers. So, but Scott, let me let you answer.
Yeah, so for me, Scott, you ask about a time frame, and it's, for me, it's all about expectations, right? When the portfolio is performing in line with expectations, and you have an explanation as to why there is performance that might otherwise be seen as disappointing, then I think patience is the watchword. This quarter, our expectations were not met, and that's why the yellow flag is being raised now. So it's not a time period. I mean, there may be a time when you just say, oh my God, I can't take it anymore, we got to do something. But we try and avoid or resist those impulses.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one, and we can probably move on. It's just that when we have managers who have chaotic performance graphed out, right, where you're up, down, up, down, and, you know, I know we're not a what have you done for me lately approach to managers, and I fully understand why, and I think it's wise and reasoned. I just, you know, clearly, I mean, I guess I'll just stop and await the deeper dive, but we'll be anxious, as I know everybody else will be, to hear what the result of that is. Jay Kwan, you had your hand up.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to chime in here and say that, you know, I think Scott's exactly right here. Patience is kind of the key thing for all the stakeholders to have, including staff and trustees. But it's very important when you're underwriting an active strategy as part of your due diligence process to form a set of expectations for how that strategy is going to perform in a given market environment. And if you have that environment and then they don't meet expectations, that's a reason for some kind of decision to be made, right? But you know, the idea that you have expectations and you're doing quality due diligence, that's why you have a professional staff. And that's why I think the staff is in the best position to kind of evaluate these managers on a day-to-day basis. And so when I look at the reports to kind of evaluate how the active strategies are doing, I try and pay more attention to, the staff report that he follows up with in his evaluation of how the strategies are performing given or relative to the expectations under which they were originally underwritten. So taking half a step back, though, it looks like, you know, at least for this calendar year or this past year that you're reporting on, the equity portfolio, a lot of the underperformance relative to policy just looks like an overweight to small cap and EM. relative to ACWI. I was wondering if you had a breakdown on kind of the allocation versus selection.
Yeah. So that's an astute observation. And part of the work that we're going to do is looking at the benchmark, and we'll look for benchmark mismatches. There's a tried and true quantitative method for doing that to see, you know, is this really an implementation issue, or is it a benchmark issue? And we're going to start there.
Sorry, thank you.
Okay. I guess I'll pause again for any further questions or discussion before I move on, just with some concluding comments.
So I don't see any other hands up, but just a final question on this, which is that in your mind, have we fully addressed, at least based on what we know now, the resolution of the private equity, private markets benchmarking conundrum? In other words, have we taken the right step in your judgment, and going forward, are we comfortable with what we've done regarding the change in benchmark?
Yeah, I think so, Scott, but as part of that benchmarking review, we'll take a closer look at that. I don't expect any changes, but we're going to look at that.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So good news generally, because the portfolio directionally did what it was supposed to do. Disappointing news that we are going to address with a deeper dive, essentially, not re-underwriting, but looking comprehensively at active management in the portfolio and seeing if there are other appropriate changes to be made. There are parts of the portfolio that are performing great and within and exceeding expectations, mostly in the private markets. You look at, but not only in the private markets, if you look at your private credit, your private real estate, and your private equity, particularly recently, the performance has been contributory to overall fund performance. So I didn't want to leave on a sour note. There are some things that we need to look at and things that we need to do. But generally, the portfolio is performing well, in line directionally with expectations, and parts of the portfolio that are performing really well. And with that, I will stop sharing and pause for additional comments.
I'm looking around to see if there are any other hands up. Jerry.
You know, the irony in this is the speed with which, I'm not saying the speed is wrong, with which Cesera ends up making evaluations and decisions to move or get into a market or get out of an equity manager. And it's interesting that sometimes by the time they hit the radar screen and we're looking at them and we're watching that it's going down and we start an evaluation process, a number of these firms will have made a dramatic change and we stop making the evaluation. And I understand why. It's sort of like, well, it looked like they snapped back. So it's almost as if the inertia, appropriate, I think, in some cases, keeps us from making snap judgments in cases. And it takes a lot for us to give up on somebody who generally has to meet that standard of having been a laggard for quite some time. And
I think that's right. And I think you're astute in your comment that inertia can sometimes be your friend and helps you be patient.
Checks and balances in the system. Any other comments or questions for Scott? I'm not seeing any. So thank you, Scott. Very insightful as always. This was pretty meaty, pretty substantive on these points. So
thank you all. And I've got another agenda item up, so I think I'll just keep my camera on. And
that sounds appropriate. So let's on the total portfolio though, on 5B. Tim, I'm going to turn the floor over to you.
Yep. And I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. If it will let me. There we go. Um, Apologies, we moved off my page momentarily. Can everyone see the screen at this point?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So Scott obviously went through a lot of the market background and some of the performance issues. So I'm going to go through my comments here fairly quickly, but happy to answer any questions along the way. Just as a quick reminder, and Samson, since you haven't seen some of these before, this is the accompanying staff report to the consultant's quarterly review. So we take a look a little bit, we take one step back and say, you know, are we meeting our functional goals? And, you know, is the level of complexity we've taken to implement the growth, diversifying and liquidity portfolios, is it worth it? Could we have just done a passive version and made it easier on ourselves? So this one just takes another step back there. So I am going to go to slide 3 and just take a look at the report card here. I think the story around liquidity has remained consistent. This is a short duration, high quality portfolio. With rates rising, we have seen negative returns in this space, this is a buy and maintain portfolio, so we don't tend to sell it and lock in short-term losses. It's whatever we bought it at, the coupon that we realize over time, and we tend to hold to maturity for most of the managers in this space. So that's working as expected. You see there, it has 25 months of benefit payments in as of the end of June, and that's at the low end of our range because obviously we did the rebalancing in July to refresh that, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. With the growth plan, I think, you know, this compares all of our growth sub-portfolio to the MSCI ACWI, which is Global Equity Index. Here we've seen some improvement as the public markets sold off. We've got a trailing 5-year return of 7.7. So we're looking for this to be the growth portion of the portfolio. So we are seeing that, you know, high single digit return there. We have a superior return to ACWI over that trailing 5-year period. And we have a higher Sharpe ratio. So meeting expectations in aggregate there. That does not discount at all Scott's comments about the domestic equity challenges and active management challenges. But if we look at the growth sub-portfolio in its aggregate, public and private assets, it's meeting long-term functional goals. Risk diversifying, as it has been, is where we have some more challenges. You know, this is what we're looking, I mean, we're looking for a real rate of return here, and we're looking for flexibility to be able to redeploy this in a market dislocation. So we want the correlation somewhat lower than what it is now. The 0.8 is really being driven by the fact that we had high correlation between stocks and bonds over the past year. So as stocks pulled back, we saw the bond portfolio that's a component of this pull back, quite sharply as well. U.S. treasuries are off 10% year to date. We don't typically see U.S. treasuries off 10%. So that pullback and that high correlation with the stock market hurt us there. The effort over the past 3 years has really been to diversify the manager lineup here away from fixed income. And we will see that the managers who were less reliant upon fixed income held up a whole lot better during this time period here. So we look for positive real returns. Don't have that. We had negative 3.5% real return. The nominal return, just the total rate of return, is positive, barely. But we do see some improvement there from where those numbers were 2 years ago. So the additions have been helping, but we have a challenge on the fixed income side. So let me pause before I get into the individual programmatic report cards and just see if there's any upfront questions.
Well, I guess it's, I don't know if it's a question or an observation, but in light of the presentation from Verus and just kind of looking at the overall, while we are meeting expectations in the liquidity and growth side, we're meeting expectations, but we have concerns, it sounds like, in terms of our performance relative to either peers or the market in general. And so I guess more to come on that, but meeting expectations isn't necessarily always a positive thing in that sense, right? You
know? Well, I would say meeting expectations in the aggregate, but we have sub components that are not, and, okay. And we can get into that here.
All right, fair enough.
So let's take a look at liquidity sub-portfolio. Again, you see a lot of green here. We do see negative one-year returns from all three portfolios as rates have risen. You know, think of these as buy and maintain portfolios for Insight and SIT in particular. So we don't tend to lock in the market movements. It's more you buy the security and you hold it to maturity there. So we do expect to see some recovery. I think the pain is in on the fixed income market largely, unless we have some more distress in the credit space. And even if we do, we're underexposed to credit in this portfolio. So, you know, I think the story is largely processed and in the numbers for fixed income. That might not be the case for the equity markets. But this one, we don't have concerns right now. I think we're in pretty decent shape here. If we take a look at the growth sub portfolio, you know, you got a lot of negative returns. It's a very difficult market environment. And we're going to talk about, we'll do a bit deeper dive on the growth sub portfolio at the September meeting. But one of the things we've taken a look at is, you know, where were our 1 year trailing returns as of July 31 last year versus July 31 this year? And it's just, you know, up 20, down 30. It is very sharp demarcation. The highest performers are the highest underperformers over the past year. So a difficult environment here. I would say, you know, from a portfolio management assessment, everybody is implementing as expected. We did terminate Jackson Square during the quarter, so they're not on here any longer, but the managers that we have, apart from the market conditions, you know, we're not seeing additional concerns come up there. Going into the return expectations, a little bit deeper dive here. You know, we're still seeing 10-year results in the domestic equity space in the, you know, low double digits. That's, you know, higher than we expect over a long period of time. International equity has been a laggard relative to domestic equity over the past 5 and 10 years here. I'd say with Pureford and William Blair, they are implementing their style as expected. William Blair certainly had a tough 1 year return, down 30%. TT the same, Artisan down 27%. So the managers had that growth orientation. You're really seeing that hurt over this period, and you're seeing the value managers outperform. One of the reasons we have both styles in there to diversify that. You will note that I put performance in line with expectations marked as no for both emerging markets managers. This is not because the managers themselves are underperforming. They're actually outperforming since inception. It's the space. The emerging markets as a space has been exceedingly challenging. And, you know, taking a look at the level of risk, we're assuming, you know, we're looking at 3% and 1% rates of return over 5 years. And those are superior to the index. But that space has just been very challenging. And Scott and I have had conversations around EM and the dominance of China in that emerging market space and trying to create a more nuanced view around that. So I would say there's probably more to come on that front as well. But the domestic equity is a, you know, a bit more of a priority right now to see if the puzzle pieces fit together the way they did 5 years ago, or if something has changed and we need to make an adjustment. Take a look at page 9 on the diversifying. Here you see that the correlation numbers, particularly for AFL-CIO, is higher than we'd like to see at 0.7. With the new managers that don't have the fixed income orientation, Acadian and SIT, you know, much lower correlation numbers. Take a look at the 1 year returns, about flat. So divert when, you know, the equity markets have sold off dramatically, you know, these managers have held up better. Acadian and SIT in particular, AFL-CIO down 10%, given the manager's orientation towards government guaranteed securities, that is roughly in line with what treasuries have sold off over the past year. But we do want to see some improvement there. And then you put it all together. We want to maintain upside downside gap here. We want to capture more upside than downside relative to this simple target index. We do see that gap is maintained, but it has narrowed. That's not the trend line we want to see. So that's where we want to do some more work on that front. And, you know, this really is, you know, the last few quarters have, we've seen some deviation relative to expectations, and that's where we want to do a much deeper dive to understand what's going on. And, you know, is everything fitting together the way we thought it was? But we wrap it all up. So quarterly, you know, attribution analysis relative to the simple target index shows added value there. If we take a look at trailing 1, 3, 5, and 10-year periods, we've had a higher rate of return with less risk and a higher Sharpe ratio relative to that simple target index over time. So we do see the efficiency of the implementation in aggregate is still there. That is my prepared remarks on this item. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions or comments for Tim? I'm looking. I don't see any hands up.
Oh, I've got my hand up.
I'm sorry, John. I know. So you go ahead.
I understand. Okay. Tim, would you spend a little bit more time in emerging markets? I everything I see out there says stay away. Whether you're talking South or Central America, whether you're talking China, whether you're talking Africa, where do we see positive now? Maybe not now is the wrong answer, but where do we see EM going that's positive, and where is that going to take place?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think, you know, emerging markets have been a difficult space for most institutional investors over the past 5 years or so. In two things that come to mind there. One really is this growth of China as the dominant factor in the investable marketplace. I mean, China is now, and Mr. Whalen, please correct me if I get the number wrong, but I think 35% of the emerging markets index, and it's been as high as 42%. So it is, you know, it's akin to going back to the late 80s and early 90s when Japan was absolutely dominant in the developed market index, and you kind of had to take a view on that one country and then everything else. So, I mean, it's been a difficult one to manage around that China exposure, and, you know, how much do you want to, you know, work with countries that have, you know, obviously very different legal environments and different philosophies around shareholder engagement and, you know, profits sharing to flowing to shareholders and that sort of thing. That was a growth engine for a long period of time. The performance of the stated performance of the Chinese economy relative to what we're getting out of the Chinese stock market has been divorced for a period of time. You know, the competing factor there is we keep looking at this and saying, but it's very, very cheap relative to its own history. And that, you know, that inexpensiveness makes it attractive on a going forward basis. Could we look at this and say, there's still economic growth. There's still economic activity expanding there. You have expansion of private capital, and it's not trading at premium. So, you know, I think, John, to your point, when the headlines were all negative, that's helping to depress some of the valuations. But we do look at this and say, relative to EM's own history, it's very, very inexpensive, and all things equal, we would expect that, you know, some reversion to the mean on the valuation front there. But it, you know, it, emerging markets is always going to be a more challenging space just because of, you know, you have very dynamic economies, and that can be positive or negative, and that can change rapidly. And geopolitical risk is very, very present in a lot of these. Companies' supply chains and, you know, customer bases and that sort of thing. So it's a very conflicted space. And I don't mean to not answer the question, but we do have those competing. It's so cheap, it's attractive, but it's got a lot of challenges.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim, with China, I mean, with the severe drought and the heat wave that they've been experiencing and the impact on productivity, but then also with the military aggression and posturing and so forth. And it just seemed, I'm wondering how much that China is going to have to withdraw from their attempts at expansion and so forth, just to address their own domestic issues, and how that's going to impact their growth going forward.
I don't have an answer for you. I think that's clearly a risk. But I will say that, you know, we've had a pretty consistent narrative, at least coming out of the U.S. government over the past two administrations, that, you know, we need to onshore and we need to decouple some of the supply chain linkages and that sort of thing. You know, the Chinese share of global exports has only increased over that time period. So, you know, this is something where, you know, despite a lot of the headwinds, they're still continuing to expand. And so I think we kind of have to take that with a grain of salt and say, you know, because this is a very different way of running a country than what we have here in the US, you know, you kind of have to understand it on its terms and then figure out if that works for you or not. But yes, sir, I mean, look, drought is drought and you lose hydroelectric power and things get more expensive. That's going to be a drag on your economy. That's not unique to China. You know, we're seeing some of it here. We're seeing the energy prices spike dramatically in Europe because of the weaponization of the commodity market by Russia. But we have challenges around the world on that front.
And I guess
I'm sorry, Jerry, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I don't want to, I won't use some more colloquial phrasing of this in public comments, but I'd like to see us not be totally consumed by the idea that something is cheap, therefore it's good. A poor product that is on sale half price is still a poor product. So I just want to make sure we get some sort of a balance here that suggests if there are underlying weaknesses in China as an area to diversify or continue to diversify, even though it's cheap, doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think I Tim can speak for himself, but I interpreted that as a more general statement of investor sentiment as opposed to a fund position. But
yeah, no, I mean, we take a look at this in the asset allocation review every 3 years with, you know, tweaks along the way. And I know Verus has been updating the view on EM, China, you know, the combination, the separation of the two, but it is one of those things that if you buy into EM as an allocation, you are de facto buying into China as the major engine behind all of that. So that is more of a bigger picture conversation.
I thought it was interesting that although I contend to be Apple centric at times, that Apple has diversified and is going to shift the production of at least the iPhone 14 out of Foxconn China into Vietnam, which I thought was noteworthy. It was a small news item, but it was telling, I thought.
And that's not the only move. They're making moves, or certainly anticipating moves, elsewhere in the Southeast Asian universe. I'm not bringing it all the way back to the United States because I think it'd be still viewed as cost prohibitive, but taking it out of their China-centric position. Yep. And I don't think they're alone.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting development.
Yeah. Just I was going to ask if there were any funds that try to remove China, any emerging market funds, where there might be opportunities for the surrounding areas, such as Vietnam and Indonesia and so forth.
Yeah, we've had many of those conversations, both with our existing managers and with other managers, around what does EM ex China look like. And I think both from a exposure standpoint as well as a growth expectation standpoint, you start to lose a lot of the, you know, the powerful engines. Now, that's not to say you can't find good companies. It's just from an index, from a market definition standpoint, once you take a third of an index out, you know, that's an awfully big chunk, and they're still a dominant consumer of goods, services, commodities. So you, it's kind of, if you play in that sandbox, you're going to have some view on China. You know, we have broached the subject with many managers. Running EM ex China is just not something that I think most folks think would be successful over time.
Isn't this a similar conversation, though, to ex Japan? Because the same kinds of things were being said at the initial point where people were considering diversifying that, and ex Japan still exists. And the lost decade has turned into the lost three decades for Japan. So I think it's still something worth looking at.
It is. And here's the difference, Jerry, and I've brought up that analogy with folks. Japan was trading at all-time highs. You know, its valuation of its domestic stock market was at an all-time high, and it was a dominant portion of the index. Here with China, their securities are not trading at all-time highs. They're just large. And so it's a little bit different conversation, but your point is well taken. The conversations are ongoing. I know I've bothered Scott and his manager research, or his capital markets team, to come up with some of views on kind of divorcing the two. Yeah, I'm just sharing the feedback on what those conversations have looked like to date.
Yeah, speaking of Scott, he's been trying to get a word in edgewise, I think, for about the last 5 minutes. So Scott Whalen, go ahead.
I was just going to stir the pot a little bit more and, you know, maybe cause people to take a step back. But our portfolio management team that has discretionary authority over some of the clients that we work with are actually have a max overweight to emerging markets. So you can take that for whatever it's worth. But a lot of the reason is, you know, fundamentals relative to the rest of the world. And, you know, not to get into a fist fight with Jerry, but fundamentals and historic cheapness.
Yeah, it's cheap. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments before Tim moves on? I'm not seeing any other hands. Well, let me check, because I missed John previously. So give me a moment here. No, I think we're good. Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. That concludes my comments on 5B. So.
All right.